I'm going to be passing around a clipboard asking for your suggestions for future services. We're looking for ideas of topics to cover, people you might know who would make good speakers. If it's a prior service that you'd like to do more on, that's fine. Or if it's a brand new idea, that's good too. Take your time, think of ideas, and write something down and pass it on. Thanks.
We, the members of Prairie, wish to associate ourselves together in a religious community which affirms that we share common humanity, that we need one another.
Sing your songbook too.
And that our futures are inescapably bound together. Together we would expand our intellectual horizons, enrich our sensory experiences, and deepen our emotional sensitivities. We would sharpen our ethical awareness and broaden our sense of social responsibility. We would stand tall in our quest for integrity of life, yet not at others' expense. As the prairie stretches out until it becomes one with the sky, let us reach out to touch and be one with the natural world and with one another.
That last line is good for today. This is Earth Day. When we started to work on this series, I guess we didn't realize, or we had forgotten, or nobody told us, or something, that this was Earth Day. So you got a program today on the death of the worker. However, it is Earth Day. There is only one of them. One Earth. The only one we've got. My mother. My mother Earth. The old saying goes, call your mother. This is the day we remember the earth. Call her. So today, the chalice for Mother Earth. Long may she live and prosper. Good. What is work anyway? How's it different from play? This guy up here. What's working and what's playing? Why have we got two different words for these things? Do you know?
Well, working is doing something that gets a job done and will help something bad. Like if a person should work for something bad and do something bad.
Uh-huh. Okay. It's different from playing, is it? Playing is what, was that like? Uh-huh. You get that? Okay. Working is something you got to do to get a job done. And playing is something you do to have fun. Is that what you think? No, what do you think? You had your hand up. What's the difference between playing and working? Do you know? Oh, ask her. Okay. Oh, for anybody. Anybody. That's getting packed. We got a pecking order or something right up down here. Sociology at work. Is there a difference between? Yeah.
Work is what you got to do, and play is what you want to do.
Yeah.
From the song in Porky and Bess. Line goes, I ain't got no shame doing what I likes to do.
Doing what I likes to do. Okay.
Work is what you complain about.
Oh, yeah.
I have to say that if you remember the program we did, the things that we love, I do that with a group of women on a retreat weekend, and not one of them mentioned work and what they love. And I think that's so sad, because personally I love my work, and I like to think people that work with me love their work. And I want to say something positive about work. Work can be doing something good, as Eric said. Work can be earning a living and doing something positive at the same time, ideally.
Well, in my line of work, work is what I do during the weekdays and get paid for it, but do on the weekends and volunteer for it.
Yeah.
One of my friends, I recently published a study of middle-class, non-class women who were community organizers. They spent lots of time on this. They were high-skilled organizers, but because they didn't get paid for it, they didn't find it as real work.
Somebody, and I think it's, Norman told me it was John Kenneth Galbraith, has said that the reason, one of the reasons that the feminist movement was so strong in America in the 60s and 70s was that the American middle classes were not in the habit of employing domestic servants, unlike their counterparts in Europe, even though they could well afford it. So you had a bunch of well-educated, highly trained people basically doing housework. Yeah.
Other cultures don't make the split between work and play. Sometimes they make it other ways. And there's one African society that defines play as versus war. And so what we would consider work is in their play category.
Yeah.
Just learning about work. Work can be what you can run away to run away from your child that wants to play.
Those work a lot down there.
Work can be addictive.
We're doing on time. Yeah.
I don't have it.
Okay.
And I would just like to say, just remind people, this all sounds very nice and idealistic and middle class. I think if you throw up this question to a group of people, of the many people who work in factories, on assembly lines, and so on and so forth, you get vastly different answers.
Probably would. Yeah. You're defining, little by little, what we're going to talk about today. It's really nice. I appreciate it, because I hardly had the time to do it.
I think different countries and cultures have different attitudes toward work.
Yeah.
Germany seems to have a wonderfully positive attitude toward work. You know, there are expressions like Arbeit macht frei, Arbeit macht das Leben süß. The last quote, work makes life sweet. But the Jewish Yiddish dialect turns it around and says, Arbeit macht das Leben süß, which means work makes life miserable.
Well, my mother used to say that work is a blessing, and of course I never believed her until one time I came out of school and my bicycle had been stolen. It was gone. And I felt awful because that bicycle was a very, very important thing to me. And so I went home and I was just feeling awful. And for some reason I started to clean my room. And I cleaned my room and I forgot all about my stolen bicycle. And then I happened to look out the window about a half an hour later, and there was my bicycle parked in the yard. And I still don't know what happened to it, but I realized that work was a blessing.
Two more.
I need to rebut what George just said.
Oh.
I think George is operating far back premise. Number one, Arbeit macht das Leben süß, one of those horrible proverbs, meaning work makes life sweet, one of those horrible proverbs.
Early to bed, early to rise.
During the century, the time of industrialization and the Romanian Empire, no German today would say that. And I found after living 12 years in Germany that the German, West German, is much more than people. He applies their free time. Nobody pays as many trips on holidays as the Germans. And I mean, as Americans living over there, we were all envious. And the other point I need to make, this phrase, Arbeit macht
that leaps by, working free, was one of the most cynical things written over the entrance on one of the concentration camps. So that was the one of the most cynical misuses of that term by the Nazi church.
Hey, Jack, the other one.
Work and play can both be fun, but our society is set up in such a way that most of the time, for most people, work is not fun.
Some of us make work out of play, of course. Anyway, let's. I want a couple of volunteers. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry.
If work was really good for you, you wouldn't have to be paid to do it.
That's a thought.
What?
Yeah, but he doesn't get
paid. On the other hand, if you've been out of a job for 6 months, you sure as heck would like something to do.
That's some good thoughts here. Just before the kids go, I need a couple volunteers. I'd like three people that work come up here. And could I get three kids to volunteer? Just any three people that work at random. Come on up here. Oh, no. Surprise, surprise. Okay, we got two more people. Okay.
It's working women.
Yeah, that's good. Okay. What I want you to do is to, in pairs. Let's start with you, Anne. Would you say what the name of your job is? And then I want one of you guys to mime with your hands what it is that she's doing when she's working.
I teach.
Don't do that. What does a teacher look like? If you just see them on the television with no sound. That's right. Who'd like to try that one? What's a teacher do? Without words. You're all in school. What does your teacher look like? No? Anybody want to volunteer? All right, Mary.
Well, you're teacher. Teacher, and I'm going to be a teacher again. And I write on the board some.
No words? No words.
Oh.
Yeah. Pat?
Let's say I conduct tours. I can't say it. The title is.
Okay, what else do you have to do?
Let's say I'm a tour director.
Tour director. If you saw a tour director on television, what would she be doing? If you had the sound off. Anybody want to try? You really? No. Anybody? This is like a quiz program. If the panel can't get it, we throw it over. Tour director.
I run a store. You pretend you're selling things? The cash register? You punch up some things on the cash register?
Nope.
Put it in a bag?
No.
No?
Sure.
Sure. Sure. Well, at least we have our hat today.
Oh, they got a big hand of them. Big round of applause. Thank you much for it. Song for the kids. Fountain filled with blood. You know what blood is. This is S song by sung by Helen Bunche Schneider from Baltimore. She didn't write the words, a woman called Joan Boyd wrote them. And it's a nice song that ties together our theme today, the death of the worker. And you'll find out what that means sooner or later. With Earth Day, there is like one verse in this that's good for Earth Day. Listen to it once, and then sing. laborer, strictly muscle work. Pick it up, put it down, pick it up, put it down. We handle between 40 and 50,000 pounds of steel a day. I know this is hard to believe. 400 pounds to 3- and 4-pound pieces is dying. You can't take pride anymore. You remember when a guy could point to a house he built, how many logs he stacked? He built it and he was proud of it. I don't really think I could be proud if a contractor built a home for me. I'd be tempted to get in there and kick the carpenter in the ass and take the saw away from him. Because I'd have to be part of it, you know. It's hard to take pride in a bridge you're never going to cross, in a door you're never going to open. You mass produce some things and you never see the end result of it. I worked for a trucker one time. I got this tiny satisfaction when I loaded a truck. At least I could see the truck depart loaded. In a steel mill, forget it. You don't see where nothing goes. I got chewed out by my foreman once. He said, "Mike, you're a good worker, but you have a bad attitude." My attitude is that I don't get excited about my job. I do my work, but I don't say whoopee-doo. The day I get excited about my job is the day I go to a head shrinker. How are you going to get excited about pulling steel? How are you going to get excited when you're tired and you want to sit down? Not just the work. Somebody built the pyramids. Somebody's going to build something. Pyramids, Empire State Building, these things just don't happen. There's hard work behind it. I'd like to see a building, say the Empire State. I'd like to see on one side of it a foot-wide strip from top to bottom with the name of every bricklayer, the name of every electrician, all the names. So when a guy walked by, he could take his son and say, "Oh, see, that's me over there on the 45th. And I put the steel beam in." Picasso can point to a painting. What can I point to? A writer can point to a book. Everybody should have something to point to. And it's a not recognition by other people. To say a woman is just a housewife is degrading, right? Okay, just a housewife. It's also degrading to say just a laborer. Difference is, a man goes out and maybe gets smashed. When I was single, I could quit, just split. I wandered all over the country. You work just enough to get a poke money in your pocket. Now I'm married and I got two kids. I worked on a truck dock one time and I was single. The foreman came over and he grabbed my shoulder, kind of gave me a shove. I punched him and knocked him off the dock. I said, "Leave me alone. I'm doing my work, just stay away from me. Just don't give me the with the hands business. Hell, if you whip a damn mule, he might kick you. Stay out of my way, that's all. Working is bad enough, don't bug me. I'd rather work my ass off 8 hours a day with nobody watching me than 5 minutes with a guy watching me. Who are you gonna sock? You can't sock General Motors, you can't sock anybody in Washington, you can't sock a system. Mule, an old mule, that's the way I feel. Oh yeah. You know what I heard from more than one guy at work? If my kid wants to work in a factory, I am going to kick the hell out of him. I want my kid to be an effete snob. I want him to be able to quote Walt Whitman, to be proud of it. I work so damn hard and I want to come home and sit down and lay around. But I got to get it out. One foreman I got, he's a kid. He's a college graduate. He thinks he's better than everybody else. He was chewing me out and I was saying, yeah. He said, "What do you mean, yeah? "Yes, sir." I told him, "Who the hell are you, Hitler? What is this yes, sir bullshit? I came here to work. I didn't come like a crawl. There's a fucking difference. One word led to another and I lost." Automation? Depends how it's applied. It frightens me if it puts me out on the street. It doesn't frighten me if it shortens my work week. You read that little thing. What are you going to do when this computer replaces you? I'll tell you. You blow up computers. Blow up computers. I'll be goddamned if a computer is going to eat before I do. I want milk for my kids and beer for me. Machines can either liberate man or enslave him, because they're pretty neutral. It's man who has the bias to put the one thing one place or another.
McDonald's, we do it all for you. They called us the green machine, said Jason Pratt, who recently retired McDonald's crewman, because the crew had green uniforms on that. That's what it is, a machine. You don't have to know how to cook. You don't have to know how to think. There's a procedure for everything, and you just follow the procedures. Like that, I was used to being Jason for pizza, I was crushing this old McDonald's. Like the worried teenager searched for a way to describe the all encompassing procedures. Okay, we'll start you off with something simple. You're on the 10 in one wheel, 10 patties in a pound, your basic burger. The guy on the bed calls 6 hamburgers. So you lay your 6 pieces of meat on the grill and set the timer. Before my eyes, Jason conjured up the Indian mechanized McDonald's kitchen. Beep, 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 beep. That's the beep of the serum. It goes off in 20 seconds. It presses each of the 6 patties down, the system in the wheel, with an imaginary silver disc. Now you turn off the sear beeper, put the buns in the oven, set the oven timer, and then the next beeper is to turn the meat. This one goes beep, 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 beep. So you turn your patties, and then you drop your recons on the meat. T-con, T-con, T-con. Here Jason takes 2 imaginary handfuls that reconstitute the dumplings out of water, sets them 2 box at a time on top of the 6 patties that he's arranged 2 deep rows behind the oven. Now the bun oven buzzes. There are half a dozen different timers with distinct beeps and buzzes in the McDonald's kitchen. This one turns itself off when you're looking out the door. So you just take out your crowns, line them up, and give them each a squirt of mustard and a squirt of ketchup. Mustard in the right hand, ketchup in his left. Jason wheels the dispensers like a pair of 6 shooters. Each dispenser has 2 triggers. One fires the pre-measured squirt for 10 ones. The second is set for 4 pounds. Now, Jason, slowing down. Now we get to put on the pickles. 2 if they're regular, 3 if they're small. That's then the lettuce, then you ask for a cheese count. Cheese on 4, please. Finally, the last beef goes off, and lay your burger on the crowns. On the crown of the buns, I asked, I make the visualize, on the top. Yeah, you dress them upside down, put them in the box upside down, too, then flip them over when they serve them. Oh, I think I see. Then scoop up the heels, that's the bun bottoms, put you on top of the bun corner, take the heels with one hand, push the tray out from underneath, and they land, flip, one on each burger, right on top of the recons, neat and perfect. At the official time allotted by Hamburger Central and McDonald's headquarters in Oak Brook, Illinois, is 90 seconds to prepare and serve the burger. It's like I told you, the procedures make the burgers. You don't have to come again.
There's a lot of talk these days about the new work, quote, close quotes. Government statistician, workplace sociologists, labor economists, the business press, and ardent free marketeers are telling us that the economy is generating millions of jobs that are clean, sophisticated, relatively high-paying, and mentally challenging. In short, the antithesis of the dirty, boring, repetitive, low-paying jobs that have been with us since the rise of the factory system and the introduction of office machines in the 19th and early 20th centuries. As the authorities usually define it, the new work uses computer-based technologies, the smart machines spawned by the revolution in microelectronics and telecommunications. It is work in which increased amounts of information are made available to employees, theoretically increasing their authority and making the workplace more democratic. The old work is authoritarian. It is done in steel mills and in outmoded coal mines, in traditional automobile plants, in logging tracts, in clothing manufacturing centers. The meter reader banging on your back door is an old worker, as is a stitcher at a sewing machine, a typist, a janitor, a truck driver, a toll collector. The new workers often use word processing, or other computer-based systems on video display terminals or programmable machines. They are employed in medical research, computer design and construction, advanced banking, and other office operations. In gleaming, highly automated manufacturing plants complete with robotics. On closer examination, however, the utopian vision of the prophets of the new world turns out to be largely a mirage. In reality, most of the jobs created in this country in the past decade are pretty much like ill jobs. They're generally poorly remunerated, the pay and benefits as low as management can offer and still attract the people it needs, yet avoid unionization at the same time. They're largely like jobs on the traditional assembly line, repetitive and boring. For example, a typical worker at a BDT in a large word processing factory makes 10,000 to 15,000 keystrokes an hour. Often, there is little opportunity for contact with co-workers, nor is there much chance for creativity. There are numerous other new jobs like this employing computer technology: supermarket checkout clerk, fast food worker, clerical worker in the back office of a financial house, inventory clerk in a wholesale warehouse. Every bit is dull and routinized. Okay, so you're flipping those hamburgers, as Norma says. It was Jason flipping his hamburgers. His manager, though, Jason's manager at McDonald's, he's creative. No? I'm too.
This is from a book called The Electronic Switch. John was hired at $14,000 a year. At the time I spoke with him, his annual pay was $21,000, a very good salary at McDonald's. At first, he'd been an assistant manager in one of the highest volume stores in his region. Then he was deliberately transferred to a store of private ticket clients. I got there and found it was a really great crew. They hated being hassled, but they loved work. I started them having fun by putting the men on women's jobs and vice versa. At most McDonald's, women tend to work on registers and the men on grill. But everyone starts the same way. Oh, sure, they hated me first, the guys first. But they liked learning all the stations. I also ran a lot of register lists. Since the computer table in each register indicates sales per hour, per half hour, or for any interval requested hour, the manager can rev the crew up for a wheel, on your mark, get set, go. Race with a printout ready at the cross attention line, showing the dollars taken in each register during the race. The computer will also print out a breakdown of sales for any particular menu. Central office can check, therefore, how many egg McMuffins were sold on Friday from 9 to 9:30, 2 weeks or 2 years ago, either in the entire store or at any particular register. This makes it possible to run a register list limited to Coke's, for instance, or Big Macs. Cashiers are instructed to try suggested selling. Would you like a drink with that? At all times. But there are periods when a particular item is being pushed. The manager may then offer a prize for the most Danish stock, for instance. I asked John how managers made up their weekly schedule. How would he decide who and how many to assign? That comes out of the computer, John said. It's a bar graph with the business you're going to do that week already printed in. Or the business you're going to do already printed in? Well, it's based on the last week's sales. Like maybe you did a $300 hour on Thursday at 3 p.m. Then it automatically adds a certain percent, say 15%, which is the projected annual increase for your particular store. No, the person's scheduling doesn't have to do any of this calculation. I just have to know how it's arrived at. Really, it's simple. It's just a graph with the numbers already in it. $400 hour, $500 hour. According to Hanover Central, you schedule two crew members per $100 hour. So if you're projected for a $600 hour on Friday between 1 and 2, you know you need 12 crew for that lunch hour, and the schedule sheet leaves space for their names. You mean you just fill in the blanks on the chart?
About 10 million people in manufacturing companies lost their jobs in the 1980s. and many never found new work. Older workers at large companies were still being offered inducements to leave early because so many younger workers are trying to make their way up the ladder. In 1930, two of every three men 60 and over were in the workforce. In 1950, half worked. By 1980, the figure had dropped to one in three. Even though the average retirement age has stabilized recently, the Bureau of Labor Statistics estimates that by the year 2000, only one in four men 60 and over will be working. And although there has been a surge of women into the workforce, most women still leave the workforce before they turn 60. Whereas American workers in the 1950s and 1960s could look forward to earning one-third more than their fathers, in the 1980s they earned 15% less than their fathers. Between 1972 and 1987, the average real hourly wage of American workers dropped 10%. This amounts for many to the loss of middle-class rewards, such as home ownership and a college education for one's children. Some of these statistics that I'm putting on the sheet that we put on your chairs. And some of you may realize this personally, that even though your pay creeps up 3, 4, 5% a year, look at that little chart in the top right. Average weekly pay in notional dollars has indeed gone up over the decade, but you adjust that for inflation and it's flat or slightly down. Number three.
Hey, McDonald's is.
That's your service industry, right? Okay? Not only the guy that flips the burgers, but the manager. These people are programmed. We all know that. Professionals are different. Right? Yeah? No? You mean that for every form you fill out, you have to fill out another form saying you filled out a form? You'll never be able to get this system straight. Eddie expressed his confidence in me. For the entire lunch hour, he'd been trying to explain the point system that had evolved from the time studies. It went roughly like this. Time studies in tenths of an hour had been established for each function that an FAW, a financial assistance worker, which is what they used to call a social worker, but they now call them financial assistance workers, that an FAW like Eddie performs. For instance, issue food stamp ID card, 0.3, meaning 3/10 of an hour, 18 minutes. Authorize funeral and burial expenses, 0.7. Replace lost or stolen check, 0.4. Complete redetermination, 1.8. The full list contained over 60 functions and was frequently updated. Each function, like update medical report, encompassed many actions, quotes, such as going downstairs to see what the client wants, pulling the file, filling out several forms, distributing the forms to supervisors or the electronic data processing center, returning the case file. The original time studies had identified and assigned time standards for over 1,000 actions. But how did they keep track of it all? When a worker completed a function, when, for instance, he handed his supervisor the forms necessary to record a change of address or a change of food stamp benefits, he filled out an additional form called a control slip. At the end of the month, the supervisor used these control slips to count the number of points the worker had earned. It was remarkably like the piecework system in a mink factory I visited. There, as you finished cleaning each pelt, you tore off a tag and tossed it in a cigar box for the supervisor to count. Here, as you finished adding a baby, you handed in a control slip. At the welfare center, the control slip was sometimes called a penny slip, just as it is in a garment shop. At the end of the month, the supervisor counts the worker's points, the tenths of hours, and calculated how close she came to using 100% of her available time. Each worker received a monthly report card with a percentage grade. So far, a worker wasn't disciplined unless he fell below 70%. That was the system after the time study, but before full computerization. So these control slips mean you fill out a form for every form you fill out? I asked incredulously. You'll never get it down straight, Eddie assured me. They keep changing anything anyway. 3 points. Not at all.
This is electronics then. The universal assumption is that the boss has the right to look at whatever you're doing. After all, your job is to do my job, so why are you being priced? These are the rules of the game in the era that a supervisor could creep up from behind and workers could counter by warning each other. In those days, it was an almost even match. Before electronic supervision, human supervisors were stationed throughout factories and offices in such a way that they duplicated the entire production process in that line. This shadow or silhouette workforce was costly and cumbersome. To achieve complete supervision, the company would have had to hire a full-time foreman for every worker. But electronic monitoring doesn't interfere with the workflow. Statistics are collected unobtrusively, seemingly as a byproduct of the work. Very few bosses will voluntarily give up as a powerful control tool. A U.S. Department of Labor publication estimated that in 1984, nearly two-thirds of the people who worked at video display terminals were monitored by their employers. And I don't know if you and I can attest to that, I know some employers count the number of keystrokes that are made by each of the employees, and they count the number of keystrokes that are in error after change. So they keep the total number of keystrokes and the total number of errors, and of course they can monitor whether it's taken and how long it's taken, even if the person is sitting at their desk and staring at the ceiling at 5 minutes. In less than 10 years, electronic surveillance has leapt from the factory into the office in a form that's frighteningly effective. Even Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times factory, with its corny tin machine and its camera in the bathroom, did not approach total surveillance. In our own modern times, monitoring is not only total, but it's fearfully cheap and easy. Once a worker is connected to the keyboard, she or he comes in the person.
My West visited the Wisconsin Bell facilities up near the square, and all the people that were taking the calls, the information calls, one number, they were being they were in surveillance like that, and the average time was the 20 seconds that they had to deal with you. That's what they were aiming for. And I know what I thought when, you know, when I call information, sometimes I want a couple numbers. I know they can't get me off in 20 seconds. Hurting their work record, and you know, it just seems, you know, just exactly like you said. There's no way they can get away from it. They work it.
The work ethic holds that labor is good in itself, that a man or woman becomes a better person by virtue of the act of working. America's competitive spirit, the work ethic of this people, is alive and well on Labor Day 1971. Richard M. Nixon. You can't eat for 8 hours a day, nor drink for 8 hours a day, nor make love for 8 hours a day. All you can do for 8 hours is work, which is the reason why man makes himself and everybody else so miserable and unhappy. William Faulkner. Every man's work shall be made manifest, for the day shall declare it, because it shall be revealed by fire. And the fire shall try every man's work of what sort it is. 1 Corinthians 3:13. I like my job and I'm good at it. but it sure grinds me down sometimes, and the last thing I need to take home is a headache. TV commercial for Anison. Norma said some of you might think today was about occupational health and safety and the death of the worker. We could do a program on that. That's not what I wanted to talk about. What I hope I've raised are some thoughts, some questions, and I want to throw it open to you now. My thought is, and this is only a thesis, you know, that once upon a time, there was such a thing as a craftsperson, a person who took pride in their work, had control of it, as the steel worker in Studs Terkel's book, the guy, Mike Lefebvre. This is a great book. As he said, you knew what you were doing. You had a piece of it. You could see it walk out the door. That's changing. And I think it started to change, not in the last decade, with the, it's being much, made much more efficient in the last decade with computerization, microelectronics. Starts in the 1920s when management is invented. There's really no such thing as management before that. You know, the worker got on with the job, the piece worker, the line worker. With the automobile, the factory, mass production, in came the guy with the stopwatch. The classic story, the guy with the stopwatch comes up to the orchestra. He's figuring what everybody else is doing. Well, there are so many violinists.
They're playing the minute waltz.
Yeah, probably. You know, so many horn players. Everybody's got a function. Everybody's got a job. But there's one guy that's got to go, says the time and motion man. With this guy standing up front, and all he's doing is that. That's where it starts, I think. We went through a period in this country anyway, in the 50s, late 40s, 50s, early 60s, when you could buy a house, you could put your kids through college, as somebody says here, fairly comfortably on one working person's income. Over the last decade, incomes have not increased. In fact, average family income today, more and more, counts the incomes of two people rather than one person. We are running, just to stay in place, as many of you have testified from your own experience. Women have entered the workforce in increasing numbers. It's clear that I wonder whether employers, companies have seen this as a reason, an excuse to eliminate the high-paying jobs, the kind of jobs that the women's movement was looking for in the 1970s. Back then, $15-$16 an hour jobs with the great benefits. Where are those now? Translate the dollars into today's terms. What's happening to those $25-$30 an hour jobs, if you will? The ones with the universal health insurance, the life insurance, you know, the early retirement. What's happened to unions in this country? Are all the good jobs going abroad? Where are the workers? Are they dead? Are they dying? What do you think?
Several years ago, I'm not quite sure what the year was, I remember reading an article about, I think it was Mercedes-Benz, who had decided to, as an experiment, have a team to build each car from the bottom up. And they found that they were more efficient, they had pride in their work, and so it made a lot of sense. I don't know what's happened since then, I wonder. Does anybody know what happened since then?
Yeah. Too bad, you know, it worked so well. How come Volvo didn't get the practice to its other plants, and it didn't? And the reason seems to be worker discipline. Volvo introduced the practices in a period of very low unemployment in Sweden. Absenteeism was high, and turnover was high, and productivity was threatened. After that cholera plant was built, unemployment increased, and Volvo didn't leave this kind of creative way of organizing work to
that is a good thing to do.
The Japanese kids have gone back to that recently.
What?
Some of the Japanese manufacturers have gone back to that just recently.
I think a lot of our good ideas.
In Japan.
Yeah, worker participation, but in Japan, there's not much of a pretense that it's meant to humanize the workplace. You know, the rule there is efficiency, and the GM accords to it. The rule is efficiency.
It seems to me that it's in just the last millisecond of human history that we haven't worked in groups. Most of our ancestors were in tribes and clans, and when it came time to pick cranberries, they picked the cranberries as a group, and then if there wasn't anything to do, they'd sit and make music and songs and dances, and then they'd start up again when it came time to chase the deer or whatever it was. What I've been thinking about all winter is the toxic workplace. And I have a wonderful job. I mean, I love to teach, but the isolation of it, doing it all alone without ever any group around to say anything about it, is to me, is toxic. Here's a perfect professional job that I obviously don't do, but it's done in total isolation from peers. And I can think, you know, as I taught Indian literature, Native American literature this year, of the Winnebago habit of all going in a group to the rice marshes out in Lake Winter that used to be there, and working very, very hard as a group. And then probably not doing too much work for a week and then going off someplace else, all as a group. And I almost think we've poisoned ourselves by isolating ourselves.
Well, I don't think that editing the passage ideal and anything, you know, things today are just deteriorating. I doubt that the pyramids were built, you know, out of happy human labor. I imagine that it was a system of slavery. And I know that the galleys were rowed by people who had no choice. I think somebody touched on something I'd just like to comment on real briefly, and that is where the opportunities for work are degrading or inhuman, usually people only take advantage of those degrading or inhuman opportunities because the alternative is worse. I mean, where the alternative is starvation or no health insurance or whatever, then you will put up with electronic surveillance that counts exactly on the second you take a look at that. Will put up with supervisors who interfere with what you're doing and don't allow you to do anymore. Because you don't feel you've got any better choice.
And I think that that's a crisis that's definitely coming up for the employer in America. The work pool is shrinking, and those people offering jobs that are not appealing are going to have to pay a great deal more. McDonald's, for instance, on the East Coast, in Connecticut, for instance, They bus employees in from New York City because there are no kids in Connecticut that will take those jobs. And they have to pay them higher wages, you know, $6 an hour to flip burgers instead of what they pay in Madison, which is probably $3.30 an hour. So, you know, that sounds all well and good if we say to ourselves, well, that's great, McDonald's is paying higher wages, but of course it has that ripple effect of increasing the cost per hamburger and increasing the, you know, it's a chain effect. But one thing that concerns me, and I think you brought up an interesting point, is worker satisfaction. How do you build in satisfaction? What Mike said was you used to be able to see the product of your hands. I've been speaking to someone recently who's very unhappy. He's in a job in a company where he's selling items on a national level. He's doing very well, but he's not getting the recognition, not financial, but the recognition from his employer, the pats on the back. If you read the One Minute Manager and all the new management books, they say that the employer has to be in there giving positive recognition. And that puts the employer in a whole different position. I mean, it's not the electronic surveillance kind of cracking the whip, but it's something that a lot of us find very difficult to do, which is giving worker satisfaction by giving attaboys, as they call it, giving recognition, giving encouragement, coaching a team, that kind of thing. And it kind of goes back to the family unit and the parents doing that for the children. And now you have to make your employees happy by making them feel loved and wanted and respected and appreciated. And some days it's easier to do that than others.
Just a couple of things. I was talking about people being able to support families, you know, on one income. I can think back to my own family being a kid. 30 years ago, being a kid 10 years old, and my dad you know, working for Chevron Oil for close to 40 years, it turned out, but he, you know, one salary, he may have been making $10,000 a year, but I don't think he made that much. And he was supporting, in 1962, he was supporting a wife, seven children, and mostly his mother-in-law, who, I mean, my grandmother lived with this, you know, but just got a little bit of Social Security. She had no pension or any inheritance from my grandfather or any of that stuff. And we were doing okay. I mean, we were actually able to do it on, you know, $6,000-$8,000 a year. And, you know, we all managed to get, you know, good education when it got time for college. We all had to get scholarships. But, I mean, you could do it, and we ate reasonably. We didn't have to eat generic macaroni and cheese 5 nights a week, you know. I mean, we ate fine.
You own your house?
Huh?
Own the house?
No, not at that time. Not until we got to high school. But I can't even imagine it now. If you made that kind of money, you'd be way below poverty level. I mean, it's unbelievable.
There's somebody over in the back. No? Warren.
Norma, it's a good passage. Is brought a line that Henry David Thoreau back to me. A short line. We need margin in our lives. And you see these managers rationalizing, we're skipping away at that point.
I have a couple of comments. One is I didn't know the workforce was shrinking. I thought the public workforce was increasing with the distribution of jobs and people that could go and change it. But I know in my generation, I'm part of the baby generation, and there's a lot of positions to which we aspire, but we can't get there because there's too many of us. The other point is it seems that for a long time people were told to improve themselves, better their lifestyle. And so, I mean, I think we have a lot higher expectations in my past that I know how I was raised, completely different from what I would like to have now. And it really is not possible, and there is concern about the resources available and your energy. And in fact, we do have to consider a retrenchment, not just for some people, but for everybody. And I know that's not going on, but it doesn't seem as though with the current technology that we'll be able to maintain that kind of growth and expectation and that kind of lifestyle.
Rachel.
Well, I just want to plug in for self-employment. It's the only satisfactory way to lead your life. And I feel a great connectedness to people all over the world who are sewing and making garments. It's one thing. Making garments was the greatest civilizing thing that happened to people until they were able to grow fabrics, I mean, textiles, and weave their cloth and make their clothing. They were depending on skins of animals. I think it's a great civilizing thing. And I feel a great connectedness to all the little people all over the world sitting there and sewing machines. So. Sure.
I've often said that the most satisfied workers are those that can see the results of their efforts. And I think all the jobs that exist today that have no real end result to them, it's like the workload never goes down. There's always more to do. There's always more assignments to do. And you rarely get that satisfaction of seeing the results of your efforts. And I know as a volunteer coordinator, sometimes you can give the volunteers all the strokes in the world, but if they don't feel like they've really accomplished something, then they're not going to return. And they can't see the results of their labor.
Judy.
Ken and I visited in Sweden last summer, and we were fortunate to have been steered to serve us by a main Valentine set group to stay with residents of those countries for a couple of days. And I was really struck just at the basic grunt level. The people we visited were just kind of middle class working people, and the work environment and the home environment where you are is incredibly important there. I went and visited a hospital in Sweden. They had windows, they had plants, they had wood paneling. And we visited a factory where they make electronic implements, and the guy who was giving us the tour was saying, well, we're building new quarters because this environment was an interior room with no windows. this environment is inadequate. We do different quarters because we're standing these people who are good working together.
Okay.
I think the question of worker satisfaction and enjoyment, creativity, though it is important in many ways, and we like that, as a matter of fact, it is impossible. It's impossible in our society because the aim of any business, not when we talk about small business, but of any decent-sized corporation, is to make as much as they can, pay as little as possible, and retain as much of the profit as possible. That is not the aim of society, of most people. Most people's aim is to make an adequate living, to be able to go and bowl if they want, send their kids to school, have work, be employed. That's their aim. But the aim of our system, of our business system, which you must have in order to produce things, is contrary to that aim. And so long as it's contrary, you're not going to, in a basic sense, have worker satisfaction.
Okay.
I once went out with a gentleman who was a cement finisher here in Madison. And when we were in his car, now and then he would stop and he would point to something and he would say, oh, I did this, which is what you were describing earlier. This was my curb cut. I did the facing of this building. I don't think that's funny. I really don't think that's funny. He had that pride in the fact that this was something he could literally point to and say, I did this and I did a good job. He died about 10 years ago, and I can still walk around Madison and see those curb cuts and those places that he had pointed out to me. And I thought at the time he told me this, gee, how much luckier he was than an academician who had a PhD and really couldn't point to much. But I think there's dignity in all kinds of work that you do. And even, you know, the people who work at McDonald's, the people who do real menial jobs. We had a program in here. And feed their family. They can take pride in that. So, good for the workers. I disagree with Rachel. I think businesses can be a kind of slave system.
Just a comment on that. I got an undergraduate degree in physics, very cerebral. And I am working as a former finisher of concrete. And there's great satisfaction in there. It's I have a hard time. I love the job because, like you say, I can drive by, and I did that, a wheelchair ramp on park, et cetera, just to be able to see it and visualize what's done. And my parents are always down on me. Steve, you got to get back to school again. They don't understand that. They can't see that. It's like the derogatory sense. It's a Mexican job, or et cetera, et cetera. It has an aura from the outside. You're a laborer, you're a grunt, etc. But inside, there's great satisfaction. I'm tired when I finish the day, but I can look at it. And it's really wonderful.
Now start with Rosemary, work to Al, and run here, and then that's got to be it, I think. Rosemary and Al.
I just wanted to remind people what Michelle said, and very people said about the participation of the worker in the product and seeing the product finished and so forth. I think we should not forget that this is one of the basic tenets of socialism. And just because, the alienation of the, just a minute, alienation of the worker from his or her product is one of the basic things in Marxism and socialism. And just because of the things going on in Eastern Europe now, where that kind of socialism hasn't worked, we should not throw the child out of the bathwater. And as long as we have an uncontrollable capitalism, we're never going to get to this point. More workers, not just those few who do the thing with the concrete and so forth, but if many workers are supposed to
pride in their product and so forth. And I think it sounds always very idealistic to say every work has dignity. But McDonald's jobs don't have dignity. You can ask any McDonald's worker, it's a job that makes money and you pay them and go home with it. That's awesome. But if there should be, I'm losing my train of thought here, if there should be this kind of a possibility of dignity for everyone, first of all, I think the workers are going to have to get away from this wonderful myth of the American dream and have to attain a consciousness of being workers and also admit that they're being exploited on many levels and also admit that the inundation of consumerism by the mass media, by television and so forth, is producing such wild, abstruse, crazy demands that even the little salary that some people get cannot possibly be enough. I have just recently bowed down to getting a television and I've hooked this on the stuff and I'm already so upset and turned off about the manipulation of consumer demand that is coming from here that I think we also need to keep that in mind at all times that it existed. I'm sorry, I'm sort of okay.
Being a public employee, I think that something in society needs to be examined. Because there's a tremendous amount of pressure from our society on politicians to keep saying public employees are really pissing off. The whole process of inhumane supervision is required by society in public employment. And I suspect that it's not unlike what occurs in private employment. My question is to who the author is of the first thing.
Studs Terkel.
Studs Terkel?
Yeah.
Just to comment
it's a book called Working.
The city hall in Oslo, Norway, the architect specified that the large amount of sculpture that would be in the city hall would all be any personages of workers that helped put the building together.
I don't know. Metri? Working. Get him in.
I would like to see some of the jobs that have taken over by mechanization, like street sweepers, return to people being able to individually do things so that there would be more jobs for more people. And any person at all gets some kind of job that way, no matter how intelligent they are.
Well, you wonder about that when you see people with the blower sweeping around nothing on the sidewalk.
Machines go around the car and then leave everything that's under the car. Dude.
Last summer I was working in Washington, D.C. and we were looking out our office window on a hot day to some guys working on concrete and wondering about the satisfaction they got in their job. My supervisor thought the best analogy was to the governmental regulation he was doing. He could point to his kids later in the library and say, I wrote that for him. Now that's a tangible thing. But all of this has been really interesting for me today because in 16 days, I will be starting my first full-time permanent job and wondering how I will enjoy that for the next many years.
Can I mime it?
What's that?
Can I mime it? Can we mime your job? What you gonna be doing?
I'll be working as an environmental consultant, so I'll spend a lot of time mucking around outside, a lot of time sitting.
Sherry, did you say that? Sherry first.
Well, I think the pride in work can backfire a lot because I think employers can really take advantage of that and their employees. My brother keeps reminding me how women are really vulnerable to that. And I think, I know I experienced in my own job where more is expected of you than you can do. And in order to feel like you're doing a good job, you're really working overtime for your own satisfaction. And I found that employers really exploit that. I really found that when I was a social worker. Just this tremendous pressure, never being able to get it done. And so the worker feels like it's their fault when
I used to look at the custodians were being paid the same as I was at Walmart. What a relief it would be to have their job and not all this tremendous weight on me. So I think this pride in job, you know, we have to be careful.
There's a scenario that prevails in Madison right now that is pretty much a deep, dark secret probably around the country for especially a lot of single women who maybe at one time were part of a high-earning, two-income family and are now divorced. The typical situation was one I was in was working as a paralegal at the munificent wage of $7 an hour, an incredible amount of work to do. And the realization that raising my daughter, I couldn't even have the energy or time to go to night school, and finding out that I could actually be eligible for all kinds of social service benefits, including AFDC. And the scenario before was paying, say, $500 a month combined rent and utilities, being away from my daughter 50 hours a week, working at a very tedious job where there's a lot of, you know, this monitored computer type of system that you described, to a situation where I received full financial aid to go to college, paid $71 a month combined rent and utilities, received federal Title 20 funds for child care because I'm a full-time student, have annual membership to the YMCA because I'm low income, and on and on and on. I could just keep going. Now, am I a deviant or am I a savvy mother? You know, I mean, it's a commentary on, you know, what is hidden and what is the true value of the work ethic? What does it become if that is the choice facing people? And if people, in, you know, if just the women in one town knew about that, the line the welfare office filling out their eligibility forms would not be mentioned in too long as the biggest hit movie ever played. So that's a real concern.
I think the time has come, and I didn't want to give answers, I just wanted to raise questions in keeping with our theme of, I don't know that it is technology as such or automation that's doing it to us. Other, you know, people have suggested that on a more fundamental level. I personally think you're right. You know, that it's the unending, you know, imperative drive of business to turn a profit. And as better technological means become available to turn that profit, workers end up on the junk heap. Just my thought for Earth Day. Let's do a few announcements and then let's sing a song. Jack's got it now. Announcements?
No, I should lead announcements.
Announcements. Any announcements?
Yeah. I just want to remind most people that took a volunteer form for GA in June that they need to be in by the end of this month. So make sure you get them in or ask me for another one or whatever it is.
This hat, this is your hat. No, kitchen utensils have a different place. That's up in the cabinet, in the far corner of the kitchen.
That's
a pop.
Is it labeled?
Yeah, it's labeled.
Dick?
Happens every 2 weeks. Very hard deadline. If you have an article or a notice or an announcement that you'd like it buried there, I have a pen and paper here today, right now, and I'll share it with you. Otherwise, please drop by my house, not later than 5 o'clock this evening.
Thank you.
Anyone who is not now on the Courier mailing list, but would like to be, please see me, and I'll make sure that you get on to this next issue.
Dick, you have pride and work in putting out the prayer time.
You're exactly right.
Same plants I brought before, still proceeds to prairie, but I also have a whole bunch of Lily of the Valley so if anybody would like to load it out in the garden.
Also, one catnip plant.
Yeah, I don't know how many of you got a thing in the mail from the Friends of the UUA. They're doing something that I think will be real valuable. It's another fundraising drive, but I think it's real important. It's try to, quote, capture the youth market, as it were, the young adult population, either in college or, you know, where the kids are moving out of high school and into at a stage in their lives where they may actually be interested in either keep the kids that we have in you know, in our high school groups, or, you know, get some new young adults, you know, maybe coming to us or available to us from other denominations who are looking for something else. And I would encourage people to try to give something to that campaign, because that is a kind of blank spot we have in our denomination, where we got to get some people in the really young adult age group.
One announcement and one comment. The outgoing executive board and the incoming board will meet tomorrow night at 10:30. So please be there, both boards. It's required by bylaws, but in addition, it'd be rather interesting. The comment that I'd like to make is that you have a tendency, you should, I think, I do, judge a lay ministry or anyone Sunday on the basis of, was there a lot of participation? Were people interested? And they certainly were interested in this concept of work. And I think that they should be given a good hand for that. Thank you.
So this is free for the taking. It's someone who's a medical person in the Soviet Union.
Well, today's Earth Day, and there's going to be tables on Basin Hill up by Lincoln Statue, and with all kinds of information. And then on the Union Terrace, there's going to be stuff on recycling. And that I'm going to be sitting at one of the tables. And then I wanted to also remind anybody who was interested in the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom that our annual Freedom Dinner is next Sunday. And I put an invitation on the bulletin board. We're going to have a really good speaker. Nellie McKay is a black woman writer in black literature and women's literature department, and she's got a lot of interesting ideas.
You notice that the hat that Betty is wearing is her community, what I call her community action hat.
All purpose. Pat?
Yeah, I'd like to let you know that our trip to the, our fundraising trip to the zoo and the Mitchell Domes was canceled due to lack of response. If any of you here sent money into Donna Murdoch, we will be returning the checks. But if any of you sent money into her, and if you also plan to go to the Monet exhibit but have not sent money, you might want to just call Donna and have her hold that as your deposit on the Monet trip. Otherwise, we'll send you a check back. And I had a second announcement of something, and I can't think what it was, and it was important. I'll raise my hand here.
Frank?
I just wanted to let people know that some of the state employees are picketing the governor's mansion today. I don't think they're calling for participation, but it's in line with Earth Day to let the governor know that, for example, the DNR environmental workers have not settled with the state yet, because the state isn't offering these pay increases.
I just wanted to take a real brief minute to wish everybody here at Prairie Society farewell. David and I announced a little while ago that we were going to get married, and it was at the Celebration of Diversity service, which we thought was a real appropriate place to announce our marriage. being as diverse as we are. And today, I guess it's kind of appropriate that we're announcing our departure because we're departing for reasons of work. David has accepted a position, as he was mentioning earlier, as an environmental scientist, and we're going to be in the Pittsburgh area, so I'm hoping to find work revegetating some of those mine spoils that we sang about today. So I'll be able to certainly see the results of my work, and we just wanted to take a minute to say thank you for being such a wonderful family to us the past year and a half. And we're going to miss you all very much, so thanks.
Before I forget again, the ethnic dinner circle is meeting at Ruby's next Friday night, and so far only three people have contacted me, so if anyone here would like to go, let me know after the service.
Anyone who has agreed to be a teacher for next year, there is a training coming up that the Central Midwest District RE Committee normally puts on in May, so please contact me and I'll give you information about that. Also, all the classes today did something regarding Earth Day, so you can ask the kids. That's a point of conversation that you can use if you want to talk with your secret now revealed friend. Also, I was glad that Nancy said that she brought Lily of the Valley. We're just starting our garden at our house. If anyone has overgrown plants like mint or other things like that that they would want to clear out, we'd be really happy to get rid of things like that. Do we still need lay ministers?
Yes.
Well, I think tomorrow night's meeting is the time when the two boards are supposed to vote on who the new lay ministers would be. So if any of you are interested, talk to Al or me or, I don't know, well, Al or me, or Jack.
Welcome to any visitors who are visiting this morning. If you'd like to be introduced or introduce yourselves to us now, please do. Are there any joys or any sorrows that anyone would like to share with everyone?
Most of you probably know that Ryan White, the teenager who had AIDS, died last weekend. And 3-2-1 Contact is a wonderful show on AIDS, and I have about 90% of that too. And it has lots of footage of Ryan.
It didn't make a good Friday night decent.
Well, since Judy has mentioned AIDS, I might mention that the Madison AIDS Support Network is doing something the first week in May where they're asking all of the businesses to contribute 10% of their profits that weekend. May 1st. Sounds like Orange is involved in that too, and so is our business, Cafeteria. So we hope you'll support the AIDS Support Network
by
shopping at those stores. They'll be listed in the newspaper, I think.
A real point of sorrow for me, reading through this morning's paper, that Stop Treaty Abuse is using nonviolent techniques, originally developed by Gandhi and then used here by King and others, to gain attention. They are not getting the kind of publicity that they want, and so they're going to do mass arrests starting Monday night at the boat landings, and that's a tremendous aggravation and annoyance to me that they're adopting these practices. And then a real joy, the compost pile is working.
Anything else?
Yeah.
Mike?
Maybe we should say that if the children are done downstairs, they might want to come in and see us.
Okay. Well, if the children are done, I just want to tell you that grades 3, 4, 5 went out and planted some lovely blue delphiniums, like daffodils or Earth Day. And we've got some extra sheets left over on It's Your World, Take Care of It. Lovely little things to do. And I'll just leave it on the table and just pick it up on your way out. Thank you.